welcome to episode 52 of the Alexi Sale podcast. And we've got an interview with a really interesting comedian today and a genuinely nice guy. And we also have to say that because Talal had the temerity to go on his holidays or something, that his brother Ahmed did the recording. And the sound, I sound all right, but Lee Mack sounds a bit like he's, well, he sounds all right. You've had to work hard on it, but he did sound at first like he was in a bucket, really, didn't he?
At first. I'm impressed with how much it's improved. So it's listenable. I don't want people to give me a hard time for the sound.
Well, the sound's anyway. Good. They're if you could, it, you know, but apart from the Patreon people, yeah. Nobody else is paying.
If you could hear how it sounded before,
yeah,
you would be impressed by how good it sounds right now. But it's very listenable. And thanks to my brother Maddie for stepping in to produce the episode.
Absolutely.
But Lee Mack, it was really nice. I got to edit it. I had the pleasure of editing it. He sounds really nice.
Yeah, he's a really nice guy. But I mean, also immensely popular. You know, it's not necessarily two things that generally go together.
It's true. And I always say you can tell how nice someone is by how they treat a cat, and he's very nice to Wilf.
He's lovely to Wilf. Yeah. I don't know whether it's one for the comedy aficionados, really. I mean, we do get quite deep into the business of comedy, really, but then, you know,
that's what he does.
Yeah, that's what he does. That's who we are. So without further ado, let's listen to Excel podcast with special guest Lee Mack. So, everybody, welcome to podcast number 51, the Alexel podcast. And in our tradition of having doer Marxist theoreticians analysing the ins and outs of dialectical and historical materialism, we have today our guest is Mr. Lee Mack.
Yeah, I'm worried I'm the real one.
You did get a bit panicky when I put them books there.
Yeah, you put books down to rest the mind.
Yeah.
And the way you put them there in front of me, I thought, am I supposed to have read these? Queens of Bohemia.
Yeah.
I can't see the other one, but they look like...
It's Andy Beckett, The Searchers, which is a history of Diane Abbott,
oh, really?
Jeremy Corbyn, Ken Livingstone and Tony Benn.
Yeah, no, I didn't read it, so I haven't done the research.
Sorry.
Sorry about that. You have to change all your questions.
Welcome, Lee. A great admirer of yours. I always pride myself on not doing any research or even thinking about the podcast before I do it. But
I've listened to your podcast. That's why I like it.
Yeah.
I do like that. It doesn't seem to have any edits as well. I might regret if I text you tomorrow, could you take that? I mean, no, we don't do it.
No, we do. We do. We're not. We're anything.
It's funny, actually, because I said to my book, this is right, that's it now. No more podcasts. Because I think of podcasts as the new, what I call the new Dustins. And what I mean by that is, you remember when the press went through a period of
rooting for people's
Dustins and look for stuff? Well, now they root for a podcast because they know you're unguarded. You'll do a podcast. I don't mean this one, but you'll do a podcast that not many people listen to, Pratt. So you'll say things that you wouldn't normally say.
Yeah.
And the next minute, you've had it.
Yeah.
And you've said to it, you go,
Yeah.
And they don't fact check it because
it's there.
You doesn't matter. No one's listening to it anyway. So you get away with saying anything. So. But I like this one.
We do edit out, you know, anybody. Peter Capaldi went on about the satanic rituals that he takes part in, and he asked us to take that out, and so we did.
Yeah, it's all
there. You haven't met him, have you?
I've never met him, and I'm a fan. That's one of the first ones I went to on your list.
There's nobody less likely to have any skeletons in their cupboard than Peter. So, I guess just start at the beginning, really, how you got into it. We've met once before, I think, haven't we?
Yeah.
We went for a reasonably priced pizza.
Yeah, a very nice pizza. We were on a radio show.
Yeah.
We were were guest actors. We weren't doing stand-ups on that. We were actually
Phil Ellis.
Phil Ellis. And I always, I think there's two lists. You're on the acting list or the stand-up list. Or more to the point, you play yourself or you're on the other list. And I'm on one list. I'm doing all right. That's fine. I can't ever complain. But on the other list, it's been a battle, you know, to act or anything like that. So anything where they say, do you want to play this character? I go, oh, yeah, please.
But then, I mean, we're getting to it. I mean, you are. I mean, in a sense, it's sometimes. I mean, I don't know if I'm doing you a disservice, but you are an enormous star in a sense, while at the same time being not starry at all. I mean, because you're in two massive series, and yet my perception of you is that you're not. You know, tabloid fodder, and you know.
I suppose, like we just joked about the bins and reading. Yeah. When I am that person on the story, and it's usually tittle tattle, but my mate, I don't do social media, so you can easily miss it. So much news out there now, you can miss an item that you're even part of because it's tittle tattle.
Right.
But when it's that, like, I've only once been on BBC News, the lists. When you go on the BBC News website, my story was actually had made it into the day's news. And it is a shock because I don't think of myself as being worthy of news.
Yeah. So, but then you came here on the, you got the train towards Salute to get the tube from there. Or?
I actually got a chauffeur driven Mercedes, but I was just trying to impress you with my work. Bless. I'm just getting off the train now. I was around the corner. So just give it 10 minutes and I'll walk around to his house. No, I didn't get the train. I go virtually everywhere on the train. I try and avoid going in. I'll drive myself. I don't like being driven. I'd like to pretend it's purely some sort of environmentally friendly thing. And part of it is that, but it's mainly because I don't like being driven by somebody else. I don't like the small talk.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know. Yeah, just where you from? What did you do? How did you get into it?
Well, I'm from Southport, which I know from listening to this, that's where you went to.
I was at Article for 2 years. Yeah.
We were just talking off mic. Mm. I don't know if it was the same place I went to, but I went to Southport Tech.
Yeah.
And I went because I failed my O levels.
Yeah.
So I had to resit them. Well, I didn't have to, but I didn't know what else I was going to do in life. I remember thinking, I can't get a job. I'm 16. I'm a child. I actually left school at 15 because I didn't turn 16 till the summer. So I often tell people that, like, I'm some sort of Dickensian.
Yeah, well, I left school at 16 because only because they told me to. They wouldn't let me back in.
Did you get expelled?
Yeah, kind of. Well, it wasn't. I don't know if it
you
was technically.
You were due to leave anyway, right?
16. No, I was halfway through sixth form. I must have went sixth form.
Oh, really?
I did 1 year of sixth form and then I don't know if it's technically expelled if they just tell you not to come back.
Right, yeah.
Well, so they didn't
expel me. I think that's the same thing. You know, but if you're at work and they say not to come back, ask them to sack you.
Yeah, but it was after like the second year they said, don't come back for the second year.
Right. Well, do you know what? A similar thing at the same time, because I went to resit my O levels.
Yeah.
And after a few months, they called me in
and
said similar words like, I don't really think I was like a kid still. So I was messing about and getting told off. And they were like, you're coming here voluntarily now. So why are you behaving like this, you know?
This is at the Tech. We should talk a little bit. I think it's interesting. Should we talk about the Southport Tech? So I think it was...
I was only there for 2 months. I've got a massive amount of
money. Oh, okay.
That's when they
chucked
me out.
Oh, I see. So you actually got... Well, Southport Tech was like, it was built as a round... It was a square, kind of so it was a four-sided building.
With a
kind of 1930s, right. I think. Probably, you know, the height of kind of civic pride, I think, northern civic pride. And the three sides were the Tech, which did like O-levels and A-levels and then presumably did... vocational stuff, apprenticeships and shit like that. And then the front, given the plate, was the art school.
Ah, okay.
So the whole front was the art school where I went.
Were you living there? Were you commuting?
No, I commuted every day from Liverpool, It was about, 45 minutes.
Well, Southport's always had that affiliation with Liverpool because obviously Southport became Merseyside in, I think it was 1972. So I was born in Southport, Lancashire. And then it became Merseyside. So even now I'll say I'm from Lancashire.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in Blackburn and Rochdale as well, which is very like traditional Lancastrian terms.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of people from Southport say it because they're quite snobby and want to be considered Lancashire people, right. Merseyside people. But for me, it's more about accent. People go, where are you from? It's a bit of a hybrid of Southport and Blackburn. But yeah, no, the tech was very short-lived for me.
So you're doing your O-levels there.
So I went to resit them because I failed everything. Yeah. And then I remember the day I can't remember if they literally said, you're expelled from here, or like you said, don't bother coming back.
Yeah.
Which I think we've established as a same.
Yeah.
And
because you've come out of school, and when you start, you go to a college, I mean, abruptly, again, yeah, because I was thrown out of school. When you start going to the tech, you don't realise that it's voluntary.
It's for grown-ups now.
Yeah.
And all my mates had got into KGV. Do you know KGV? KGV is the sixth form college. So our school didn't have a sixth form college. So that was the automatic place you went. You did your O-levels, you did well, and you went to KGV. And we were in the old awful days of you're an A-bander or a B-bander. You're in the top half or the bottom half, and you're set for that whole school life. Absolutely terrible. So we were in the sort of top bit. We were all expected to go to KGV. And I just messed everything up. And so I went to this college, lasted about 8 weeks. And I remember the day I went home thinking, right, I've been chucked out. What am I going to do now with my life? And I put the telly on and horse racing was on. And my granddad was into the betting a bit. But apart from that, no connection with racing at all. But Red Rum was trained in Southport.
Indeed, we're very proud.
And so he was still alive at the time. He'd retired as a racehorse, but now he was opening supermarkets and betting shops. I mean, he'd go with someone, obviously.
You'd see him in there. Yeah, you'd see him in the pub on Lord Street, wouldn't you?
Of course. And he was famously trained behind a second-hand car lot. He didn't even have gallops. He used to have to take him to the beach to train him. And they say that's why he became so good, because he had a bad foot when he arrived, went in the sea at Southport, and it mended his foot. It's the theory. And when I went, I was watching the telly, and I went, well, maybe I'll be a jockey then. Having never ridden a horse in my life, I was a skinny little kid. That was the only thing I thought was giving my advantage. And I phoned them up that day. So I remember being chucked out of college in the morning and phoning up McCain Stables in the afternoon and going, I'd like to be a jockey. Can I come and work for you?
Do you think if there'd been something else on about being a butcher or something, you would have, done that? Yeah,
you never know. Blimey, yeah. Well,
there must be something connected with you about being a jockey.
Well, I've always loved sport.
Yeah.
And I was always rubbish at sport. Well, not rubbish, but certainly nowhere near good enough at any sport to ever even consider it. And I just thought, I was deluded. I thought, well, I think the Ulster's the work. And I think I'm skinny and I'm scared, you know, because I think, again, this is me being deluded rather than having to go at the sport itself.
Yeah.
Is that there are certain sports where I think, like, you know, when you get basketball players and you go, you are the best basketball player in the world. You go, well, you're not, are you? You are the best basketball players of everyone that grew to 7 foot, which is a very small amount of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And likewise, of all the jockeys, because you have to be tiny and small, then you are the best of those.
Yeah.
So you've already had a massive advantage just physically, you know. Because I was a little, I was nowhere near the height of these
guys. Because you're not a small man.
Well, no, but there's two horse racing. There's flat racing and jump racing. Flat racing is for the little guys, like the Tory. And horse national hunt, which is the grand national and anything over.
Yeah,
they're much taller and much bigger.
Really, I didn't know that.
Not like when I say much taller and bigger. If one came in here now, you go, "Is that a little skinny fella?"
Right.
But I mean, in relation to the little, all proper flat jockeys they look like kids. In terms
is of there, I think there's a Simpsons episode, isn't it, where he offends the jockeys that all these tiny little men and
little boys.
Yeah.
Well, they there's no flat jockeys that grow tall. They'd be too heavy.
Right. There's also, I have to mention, there was, you're talking about the horse does all the way, because there's a Jerry Seinfeld line, isn't it, about talking about the luge, you know, or the...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You could literally kidnap somebody and they could enter the luge as a Olympian, really, because you're just going very fast.
And to the viewer, that, I mean, obviously, that's not what it is.
No.
There's obviously far more to it. Yeah. But as a viewer, you do go, Well, aren't you just riding on that thing? In the same as you are, aren't you just sitting on that horse?
Yeah.
But the reality is totally different, as I learned very quickly, because within a week, they stuck me. I got the job, so unpaid. I was just like, we'll let you work.
Is this part of the, so what you, when was this, 70s?
No, this was 84. So I left school in 84.
Right. Because it was like in the, you know, my memory of the 60s is that work was so plentiful that you could walk in and out of jobs. The fact that I was regularly employed in the 60s and 70s is a testament to how, so I was like the worst employee in the world, but I just could get work all the time, any job, you know, airline pilot, anything really. Because they were so desperate for workers, really.
Yeah, just walk in,
yeah.
Yeah, well, I suppose, but, I mean, look, I wasn't getting paid, so it was quite easy to pick up the phone and say, I lied as well. I remember saying, Ginger McCain's the trainer, and his wife, Beryl, answered the phone. And I said, look, I live in Southport as well, and I've always wanted to be a jockey. Brackets, well, since this morning. And I said, and the best thing about it is I'm 7 stone. Right, which was not true. I was very skinny, very small at that age, but I wasn't 7 stone. I was probably about 8.5 or 9 stone. There's a massive difference.
Yeah.
So when I turned up, she looked at me, there's no way you're 7 stone. I went, well, I'm here. I've exaggerated a bit. But they let me work there for a few months just for no money, and then they put me on a YTS. Remember the YTS?
Yeah.
So I did a year there, but within like days of landing there, I knew, because they put me on a horse, actually Red Rum, so that was the first horse I had. So that's my little claim to fame. But when I sat on that horse or tried some others and they trotted me up and down, I knew instantly that I was terrified of these things and had no interest.
Big. Yeah.
You just don't get it until you sit on them, just how big they are and how they're thoroughbreds. So they're not like, they've got their mind of their own. I think, you know, I suspect they're possibly just all a bit too inbred.
Right.
So they're very highly strung. I mean, they are national hunts, so it means they've had their balls whipped off.
Right.
So that calms them a bit. But even so, I mean, I just thought, I can't do it. I've had horses running off down the road with me on a high street in Southport, you know.
Really?
Yeah, it's just awful.
Because, I mean, I've sat on horses, you know, as part of filming, that you're playing some character on an horse, and it is, even that's terrifying.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
You just think, it's like, I mean, like I've got a moped.
Right.
And you always keep your one eye on the roads in London when you're driving that thing, and you're like, make sure that nothing's going to hit me. And if they added onto the mix that at any point the moped could do what it wants, I'd never get on it, would I? The guy turned right and he goes, that's out the left, you know. And they know, they definitely sense fear. 100%.
Yeah.
And then that gets them nervous and they feel it through. It's horrible. I have so much admiration for those jockeys. I really do. So That was a year of my life doing that.
Was it formative? I mean,
oh my God, it was.
I mean, the contradiction between something that the terrible mistake that you'd made. I mean, did that?
Well, like, the fact is, I knew within weeks I didn't want to do it, and yet I stayed there a year. And I was earning £25 a week, so it wasn't for the money. There was a certain lifestyle. I mean, it's a cliche to say you go in as a boy and you come out a man, but I suddenly was this kid, physically a kid as well. I was so small and skinny. And the next minute, I'm going out with all these Irish jockeys to pubs and going racing and spending the night at the races. And just a lot of booze, a lot of just a very wild life.
But I wonder as well, I mean, one of the things I always felt about, like, that whole apprentice system is that the young men are socialized, aren't they? They're taught, I don't know, you're taught a kind of moral codes and ethics by those older men. Or maybe you weren't.
I think there was I can't remember. It's not like I went under the wing of some great mentor that I still think worked. So, but it was just the fact of being, for the first time in my life, surrounded by people who were working rather than being at school,
or
being in education. And these guys were Irish jockeys. A couple of them were Irish jockeys. They'd come in, basically they'd left home, left their country to come to England to be jockeys. So I'm looking back, they were probably only 25 or whatever. But suddenly they become you've lost your schoolmates, but now you've got new mates that are 10 years up, 9 years older than you, and you've never been to a pub. I grew up in a pub, but I've never been to a pub to get a drink. You know, I think I've probably had my first couple of pints during that period and was puking up in the back. All the things that you go through in that period of your life. Well, I did it with toothless Irish jockeys.
Yeah. I did it with humorless Marxist revolutionaries.
Right.
Same process.
Did you
do
the same thing? Did you get drinks out of college, turn the television on, and
there was some Marxist
I'll do that then.
Saw Chairman Mao, and I thought, that's for me. Now I was.
If you'd have turned over, it would have been the fascists, you'd have been with them, wouldn't
you? Well, you sometimes think that, really. Yeah. But no, it's because I inherited my Marxism.
Yeah, right. So,
from my parents. So,
but you were like me in the sense that, from what I know about you, that you didn't. You certainly weren't at footlights.
Yeah.
No, it was you had the working life.
Yeah.
And then it was the comedy. I don't know what yours. Mine was, I sort of made the decision in my head when I was 15, I'm going to be a comedian, even though I had not.
Really?
Well, as a seed of thought, I'd love to be a comedian, but that would be like saying I want to be an astronaut. I remember thinking it.
Yeah.
But we didn't have, we didn't have the, we had working men's clubs.
Yeah.
But the revolution that you were part of has certainly not gone up north yet. It was very London-centric. And so, you know, to want of a better word, alternative comedy was 2 years, 3 years old at this point.
Yeah.
And was, from what I know, was all in London. And so my sort of people that I saw when I used to go to my dad's working men's clubs, and I didn't necessarily go, this is what I want to do.
No.
It's only when I started watching things like Friday Night Live and, you know, The Young Ones and all that I thought, that's what I want to do.
Right.
So that was early 80s, you know, 81, 82. But
that's 3 or 4 years after.
Still 2 or 3 years. But I remember thinking, I went for enjoyment, thinking, I wonder if I could do something like that. But where the hell would you start if you're from the northwest of England in the early 80s? You know, it's one thing thinking it. And I didn't do my first open spot till like 10 years after that. So I had 10 years of jobs,
right?
Dead-end jobs.
Doesn't do you any harm,
no,
I don't think.
No,
I
think
it really didn't. Well, and it is that, I don't know. I mean, for me, even more so than usual, you know, the entertainment business seemed like an impenetrable barricade, you know, that he didn't. Whereas, of course, for the children of the media classes and those footlights people, it's just you ring up. I remember it wasn't.
Were you in London then, or did you come to London before?
I came to London in 1971 to go to art school. I mean, that was my way out. Really, was because I was like unacademic. I've got 4 O levels. I've got history, English literature, and English language, and they're quite poor O levels as well.
I only got 2, and they're above C.
Really? Yeah. Well, I think 2. Well, it was done by numbers in my day, so I've got 2 threes and 2 fours.
Wow, that's good though, because you can tell people you got a 3, and no one knows anything.
Yeah,
everyone knows a C. You've scraped through.
That's
my proudest moment though, getting the geography, because in the old days, it was you were GCSE, well, you were O level, or CSE. CSE being the sort of less academic version of an O level. And they wanted to demote me from O level geography to CSE because after me mops, there's no way he's going to pass. And my mum, who just was not this type of person, wasn't having it. She went into the school. She went, he's just passed his mock O level. Why are you demoting him? He was lucky. It's not going to happen, blah, blah, blah. Come to. You know, and scraped through with a C at O level, and then about 3 or 4 years later, my mate's brother started the school, and he said the geography teacher's opening speech. Now, he's telling you now, there's a kid in the school called Lee McGillett. That's my real name.
All right.
If he could get geography O level, there's no excuses for any of you.
This was before you were famous.
So I thought, that's quite like that idea that he's using me as the benchmark of. If any idiot can do it, if that's inspirational, it's completely mocking me.
I'm not sure. So what? So, I mean, did you? I mean, there's also. I mean, do you think there's? Who was I talking to? I mean, there's so many comics, for instance, from Bolton itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like Diane. I mean, I've interviewed at least two. It's, I mean, come on, it's all actors. I mean, Diane Morgan and...
Oh, they're all over. My mate was pointing out, they're all on Radio 2 now. You've got Sarah Cox, Bill and Kay, and Paddy McGuinness. They're all from Bolton.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a real hot...
I mean, it's a hotbed, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know.
Peter Kay.
Peter Kay. I mean, the ultimate. Oh,
the ultimate.
Yeah,
the, ultimate.
The king of our...
Yeah.
The king of our business. I mean, do you think there's some, a certain kind of Lancashire sensibility? That...
Well, there was definitely true that when I was growing up in the 70s watching sort of the pre-alternative days, it was a show, you know, you'll know it, the Comedians. That was the only time you really saw stand-up on telly, from the Wheel Tappers and Shunters. And the Wheel Tappers and Shunters, I know you know this, but I'm just explaining to the younger listeners, were set in a working men's club in the north of England, although it was in a TV studio, and he learned that later on in life. So he was in a TV studio.
It was all a lie.
Yeah, all a lie. And that's what comedy was when you'd grown up in the 70s. You'd see lots of working men's clubs, comedians on the telly, and they were all joke tellers. You know, they just told jokes. They didn't have any material as such. A lot of it was shared jokes and things they'd heard, and pub gags. And there was a disproportionate amount of them, I think, from the northwest. There was a lot of Scousers, people from Blackburn, Bolton, you know, that whole...
I mean, there Manchester. Was. I think there was one who had a true kind of streak of madness about him and wasn't entirely a guy town. That was Freddie Starr.
Freddie Starr, yeah. He was. But you wouldn't be seeing him on The Comedians because the TV show, The Comedians, because you had 5 minutes.
Right.
And in fact, they used to edit it, didn't they, where you'd see one guy tell a joke, then you'd hear Frank Carson tell a joke, and back to that fella again for his next joke. And it was, I suppose it's everything that you guys sort of rebelled against.
Oh, yeah.
Because there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of sexism and homophobia and racism. It was all there in a package.
You get
them all in one show.
Yeah.
All you didn't have to go looking. It was available. But it's also true that there were comedians that weren't like that, but they all got lumped in together.
Yeah.
You know, I used to love Mick Miller at the time, you know. He had, you know, but again, I might watch it back now, think differently about a lot of the stuff I used to see, but I didn't watch it going, I want to do this. I just, that came when I started watching TV in the early 80s and watching, like I say, BBC Two, Channel 4. Channel 4 changed a lot, you know, because it was for a while, certainly when it started, it was so incredibly revolutionary in terms of what it was showing, you know.
And did they have a lot of stand-up then? I can't remember.
Not really. I mean, to be honest with you, the
comic strip.
It was because comic strip and The Young Ones was roughly the same time.
Yeah.
It was the same week, wasn't it? I think they all seemed to land at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think there was a sort of unique age gap of people like me who were too young for punk, but not too old to be not interested anymore in any art movements.
Right.
It's a very niche little, you know, you've got to be between the age of, I think, about 45. I think more people appreciate it, but I'm saying that for me, it was a life-changing thing where I went, oh my God, I've never seen anything like this before. And that's when I thought, I'd love to do that, but that is a whole world away from knowing what that means.
It seemed very London, did it, in a way?
Totally. I suppose watching it on telly was the first sort of thing in my head that flipped and wanted to do it. So I was probably about 81, was it? So 82, was it? Your one's 81 or two?
82.
So I'm probably 13 or 14 now.
Right.
You know, all the cliches that you are probably sick to death of hearing.
And never.
You were doing all the voices in the playground. I would do you. I would do the landlord. We all had our parts in that, you know, we could all do certain impressions. And then another big night was when I then moved to London and split up with my then girlfriend, was walking around Leicester Square with an old mate of mine up to visit and saw this sign that said the Comedy Store, and I went, oh, I think this is where those guys just came from, the Comedy Store. This is where it all started.
Because it wasn't the original spot.
Well, it wasn't the original spot. It wasn't the old strip club.
No.
This was the one in Leicester Square.
The one to the second one, not where it is now,
not where it was originally.
Yeah.
So I suppose the second one was more like really what you would pretty much see nowadays. Compare three or four, I don't want to say straight stand-ups, but not the variety of lunacy, perhaps, that you would have had in the old comedy store.
No, no.
with all respect. But you know what I mean? All the the variety of difference, you know. Rick and Aid Edmondson coming on and smashing things over their heads is less likely to be seen as it moved on a bit and became a bit more.
Yeah. So what year did this be?
So this was, well, it was, I remember exactly when it was the day after Thatcher resigned.
So 1990.
Because I remember that because all the comics that were on the bill were talking about Thatcher the night before, and I thought, this is incredible. They're so worldly wise and intelligent and so they know all about politics. I don't. These guys are, because it's still, and this was 1990, so it's still a very political leaning. You know, it was very, politics was the thing that you wouldn't see.
Still
no gag tellers then. It was all
It was very advantageous then for your career to be left wing as well.
Absolutely,
as opposed to now. But you'd been, just reel back a bit. You'd been doing shit job. I mean, you went to university.
So the basic order of events was I go to school, I get chucked out, I do the jockey thing for the horse stable lab thing for a year, and that takes me through to about the age of sort of 17. And then just went to a bingo hall for a couple of years in Southport, which actually, weirdly, was...
It's kind of performing, isn't it? Yeah.
You had to pick up a mic.
Yeah.
And you had to read. It was a big, not one of those rubbishy little... There's not ping pong balls in a cage. I'm talking all electronic.
Oh, wow.
You would link up with other comedy clubs. Bingo clubs win a lot of money. Rollover jackpot, all this kind of... It was taken very seriously. And you had to pick up the mic and read out serial numbers to check planes and all that. I remember the first time I did it, picking up the mic, going, I can't stop talking on a microphone. And hearing my voice echo around the room and being terrified and not realising how much doing that for a year massively helped what I ended up doing.
Because
I also then became a blue coat at Pontins. So that sort of led to that next bit of my life. So that was... Now talking 88 now.
Was it a former prisoner of war camp that Pontins? I can't remember. In Ainsdale, isn't it? Was it in
Southport? I think that might be a
myth.
There's the old joke, wasn't there, about the barbed wire. It wasn't to stop people getting into Pontins. It was to stop them getting out. But I wasn't at that one, funny enough.
Yeah.
Even though Southport has got a Pontins and still did have one of the last ones till very recently. It's just closed down.
Because they're still going now, but doing 80s, the ones that survive.
A few left now. There's like...
Yeah, but they're doing really well.
Two or three, yeah. It's more Butlins. Butlins really... Somehow Butlins survived really well and Pontins slowly collapsed down to the last two or three. But it was a huge part of my life, that.
Because
despite the fact that I ended up doing what I'm doing, I didn't go there to do it. In fact, quite the opposite. I just was working at the bingo hall, and this bloke decided he was going to be an entertainment agent for local clowns and DJs and party kids' parties and stuff. And I said, do you want to get him a snooker one? And he left and I rang him up. So I met him but at his agency. He's a little office with a, you know.
Yeah.
And as I walked in, he was on the phone and booking some clown for something. And I was waiting for him to come to the snooker hall. And he just sort of put his hand over the receiver and went, I'm going to set. We'll be a blue card punt. And I went, all right. And he went, I've got another lad here who might be interested in an audition. I'm like, hang on, audition? And he went, okay, I'll send him along as well. And he basically said to me, you don't need to be a performer. You're the type that might be all right as a blue coat. Just be with the holiday guests. And
Did you live there when you were working there? Or did...
Oh, yeah. So I got...
Really?
Yeah, but the thing is, when I went for the audition, everyone was auditioning. And I was like, I don't do anything, mate. I'm just... Yeah. I'm a very good snooker player, which is a lie. So I could teach them how to play snooker and stuff. I just bullshit away. And he knew I was bullshit, but he thought anyone that could bullshit like that, perfect to be a blue coat, you know. So then I left my hometown and went all the way to Great Yarmouth on the East Coast. And that was a proper little life-changing moment. And now, I don't think I'd ever properly left Southport. I've been on holiday. I certainly never lived away from Southport. Well, I grew up in Blackburn and Rochdale with my parents in the pub trade.
Yeah.
I'd never left home on my own. I was living in a bed set in Southport at the time, but I certainly hadn't been out of Southport to live. It was not really adventurous. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was the furthest one I could go to. It was on the east coast of East Anglia.
Were you and the other blue coats, was that quite, I don't know, was it, did you, was there a lot of carrying on between you and the blue coats?
I love the fact that you're doing that while slightly holding up your breast like this.
Yeah.
It was more of a carry on. There was. Well, I had a girlfriend that I met in the first year, and a different girlfriend in the second year. So there was a bit of carrying on.
Right.
But it was, what was great about it was that I turn up. Everyone is from this one. Remember the TV show Fame?
Yeah.
They were all from one place. They,
right.
They could dance. They could sing. They could do. They were there to put on a show as well as being blue.
Right. And
I was there to just organise the football and the darts tournament. And I wasn't like them. And I felt very intimidated. I had to be in the show, but just stand at the back and wave your hands type thing.
Right.
But then a few weeks later, then another bloke turned up, a bloke called Saul. And like me, he couldn't do anything. So they put us in a chalet together. And he's like my closest mate and still is.
No way.
We're godparents to each other's kids and best man at each other's wedding. And so we look very fondly back at that year of
journey. Yeah, well, it's a bit like being in the army, I suppose.
Absolutely,
as well,
it really is. It's you live in your little chalet, which is tiny. We shared a chalet as big as the one on Heidi High with Ted and what's his name lived. The beds were virtually touching together. It was so small. But because we couldn't do anything, we bonded in our sod the lot of them mentality.
Yeah.
So we were always quite dismissive of these showbiz types because we couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
That's why we survived, you know.
Yeah.
But we had to, there was a bar there for over 18s. And because everyone was 70 and I was like 18 or 19 or whatever, I was the only one that was allowed to work in the adult bar. So I had to host stuff. They said, they're not allowed in. They did a big show next door in the big family room. And your job is to play some records and say, please welcome this week's funny comedian, it. And then say his name. It's all you've got to do. Terrified of doing it, but you know, so I used to watch a lot of comedy in this adult bar, and it fascinated me, you know, because I'd seen all these blokes, types of blokes on the committee.
These weren't presumably the, I mean, these where were they on the pecking order if they were playing Pontins and Great Yarmouth?
Well, you'd have seen some of them perhaps they've done a bit on the comedian,
right?
But this is now 88. And the alternative revolution.
I'd ruin their careers.
I wrote an autobiography and I said, as Alexei Sale is like the Khmer Rouge of comedy. They've all been taken to a field and shot. That field being Pontins.
Yeah.
The shot, really, they were still working at Fonsi. But there was a sense of, there's no getting around it. There was, everything started again, reset in the early 80s. And these guys just carrying on doing what they'd always done. You know, when they were on the comedians, they were doing the holiday camp circuits and the cruises and all this kind of stuff. But I found it fascinating that they were just showing the jokes out and they were, they'd come in and say, all right, mate, who was on last night? Oh, so-and-so. Did he do the one about the penguin? And he did, I won't do that one. Mate. And I remember the first night I was there, the first night in the bar, I sat on the sort of edge of the stage to do the lights and the intro.
Yeah.
I was sort of not seen, but seen if they looked. And the comedian said to me, do us a favour, mate. I'm going to say to you at one point, because they always ended with a song. That was their thing. I'm going to say, I'm going to finish with the song now, ladies and gentlemen. Can we put some nice mood lighting on, please? And I'm going to look at you, but don't do anything. Oh, okay. Are you sure? Yeah, don't do anything. All right, okay. So he gets to the end. He goes, right then, Jam, I'm going to finish with a song. Can you give me some mood lighting, please? So I did what he said, and I did nothing. And he said it again. A bit of mood lighting. I did what he said, I did nothing. Tells the audience again, 3 million unemployed, and we've got a dickhead on the lights. And I guess a big round of applause, right? And I'm virtually on the stage.
Yeah.
So now they're all looking at me.
Yeah.
And I look at the audience, and I go, this can't be right, can it? Is this allowed? This is like, you've told me to say that. Now I'm just the butt of the joke, you know.
Yeah.
He sings his song and off you go. You don't have to do that every week. I'd have to, that was my job, was to sit there and take that.
Right. I mean, different sort of abuse, but you became like the kind of straight man.
Yeah, I just couldn't believe how anyone could just say, but there was also a ex-professional table tennis player. He said the same thing. He said, I used to have to be the ref. The ref, meaning the nominal ref. They'd show that they could play with saucepans on the back of their hands. They were brilliant, these guys.
Right.
They said, you'd be the ref. And the first point, when I win the first point, you've got to say, love one. I don't, that's tennis. He goes, yeah, no, just say love one instead of 1-0. Right. Yeah. Love one. Yeah. I bet you would. Love one.
That's tennis, you dickhead.
What's going on here? Like, I mean, totally set up to like a right numpty, you know. But it's just a different world of anything to get a laugh, you know. And half of me sort of understands that. I really do, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you will do. I mean,
as you get older, you start going, there are sort of things you do.
Here's Wilf.
Oh, here's your cat. I've heard times in the back. Oh, look, there he is.
Wilf.
Hello, Wilf.
He
wants to join us. Come on, Wilf. I'm a fan of this cat. He's always in your background. You know, Wilf. You know, he's
looking a bit arthritic, isn't he?
He's a bit older than those lessons.
Yeah. Let's see if I can. Thank you, Wilf, for your contribution. I don't think you're. I don't know whether he'll shut up or.
I wish I could speak cat instead of pigeon. You don't know if they're going, please help me, or hello.
Yeah.
Oh, he's lovely, isn't he?
Isn't he? He's so sweet, yeah. Is he a type of cat? Yeah, he's a Maine Coon.
Oh, Maine Coon.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice meeting Will.
Yeah, well, you.
I can put a face to the meow now.
So how long were you punting for then?
So I did.
Well, actually, no, we were talking about. So you, I mean, that's, I suppose the thing that struck you was the, I don't know, what was it about them using you as a foil that really.
If I'm going to be honest, yeah. this is what I really thought. I didn't mind being the foil, it didn't bother me at all. What bothered me was, do you know what? I thought, God, it's really easy to make people laugh. You say that, and then I'll say that. And yeah. It's like, I suppose, look, I'm on a panel again now, which is genuine just chat. Right?
Yeah.
And I love things that are real. Now, that sounds odd because, you know, I'm in a sitcom that is very not real, not improvised. But there's, for me, nothing ever has beaten just having a laugh with your mates when it comes to comedy. When it comes to comedy, that's the pinnacle of comedy.
Yeah. I mean, if I was going to talk, I mean, I think it was true. When people, in the early days, when people asked me, what was different, I suppose, about my comedy, is the thing that upset me in a way about those old school guys was it was so mechanical, really. It was just, and what I was trying to reproduce was exactly what you're talking about, was the humour that is expressed between friends, and that's what I was attempting to do.
I think
do
that's
my
probably the difference. Yeah. I can't imagine. Well, I was going to say I can't imagine the old school comics sitting around and telling each other jokes. That is not true.
No, they do each other jokes. Yeah, they can't talk to each other.
They're very interchangeable. The jokes between each comedian. You know, what you're not getting is the sense of that person.
No.
You know, of thinking, what is it? You know, that's what was amazing about watching you guys when I was watching on telly. Was going, oh my God, I think
that. Right, yeah.
You know, or a different level of connection of laughing. You weren't just smiling a bit and chuckling. You were all over the place with laughter because you thought, I thought this is only the kind of thing that me and my mates would do, this kind of madness or nonsense, you know, or whatever it was you're watching. You might be watching observational comedy, which I've never seen before, and going, I mean, literally going, I would watch an observational comic and go, oh my God, I thought, how did anyone that did that?
Right.
And he does that. This is incredible.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I think before I say you personally weren't an observational comic, but still going, I thought this is the kind of stuff that only I would find funny.
Yeah.
It's on television. Other people must be like me.
Yeah.
He's like but me. That's one he's
of the,
doing it.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the challenges, I think, is. You're one of the is getting to thoughts that people have just before they realise they're having them.
Yes.
That's being a comic, really. Yeah.
You didn't even realise you were thinking this.
No. It's a comic gets there a few weeks or months before you. But the other thing was, it was also, genuinely, me and Rick and Aid and Pete and Nigel and Dawn and Jennifer, we did make each other laugh. I mean, that wasn't put on.
That's the key thing, right? That's the.
It was very joyful that to be on the tour bus or whatever.
Yeah.
We just had such a laugh between. You know?
And I think that, even though I didn't know that, that comes through, you know, because you go, obviously you get in with comics and they ask advice sometimes, and I always go, all you can really do is do what makes you laugh, what you think is funny, and just hope there's enough other people to call it a career, that they'll agree with you. Yeah. And if they don't agree with you, keep doing it for fun. But it's even an added bonus if there's enough people agree with you or have shared the same sense of humour, because it's the ultimate in... nothing had ever made me laugh more than being with my mates. Nothing.
No.
And so to be able to recreate that, that's why I personally love... I know people aren't keen on panel games, but if they're not written... I suppose I'm only talking about Wooden Lights, you know.
Yeah, yours is the best of
them. Well, thanks. I mean, it's for me, it's never going to be as good as with my mates in the pub. But it's the closest I've found so far to do it for a living and be on the telly if, you know, and have that kind of recreated fun of having a laugh. It's never quite as good. It's not like the same with your mates. My proper mates outside the showbiz doing that sort of world of thing. But no one's interested in filming that and paying them money for that. Well, I'm glad they don't.
And that wouldn't. So you've had 10 years of shitty jobs. What sort of shit were you doing?
So between, I always say this: every job you can imagine, when you get paid less than 100 quid. I've probably been. But I should bring out, this is the late '80s, so it's worth a bit more than 100 quid. Yeah. But even so, so I was blue card sponsors. I can always remember £65 for that.
Yeah.
But it was free food and free accommodation. So I'd never been that rich.
Yeah, yeah,
I couldn't spend the money. Everyone was buying you drinks and, you know. So I did that. Oh, what else have I done? In no particular order, I've worked at the bingo hall. I've fruit picked in Australia. I've fruit picked in banks near Southport. Tomato picking.
Banks, one of my mates at Southport came from Banks,
Very small little place. Where Southport ends, it suddenly becomes very, what's the word I'm looking for? Market,
and it's very rich. So, Phil McIntyre, you know,
promoter. I
remember him talking about the soil there because it's unique and you can grow 3 crops a year.
Well, that would make sense because as soon as you leave Southport, it's very congested. So there's lots of houses. And then suddenly, there used to be a pub called The Plough, and that's where Southport ends. And suddenly, it becomes green everywhere.
Yeah.
And everyone's business is growing vegetables.
Well, also interestingly, because my relatives live out just outside. Between Southport and Aldgate now, and in their village, their town is two. There's two, well, really, in a sense, 3 Michelin starred restaurants.
Yeah,
and they said it's partly because of the soil that they can get.
Well, that would make sense. There's just so many markets. So everyone that was my sort of age at school that were looking for extra would often go off tomato picking. And I think from memory, you'd get paid. Was that the Australian job where you get paid in weight?
Right.
So you were, certainly in Australia, I did apricot picking.
Right.
And they said you will get paid X amount of dollars when you fill a certain box.
Right.
So he shows me the box and we're looking at it going, that's a big box for whatever it was, $50 or something. We were picking these things for... That box is not getting... I'm talking the biggest crate you can imagine. You couldn't pick it up afterwards, put it that way. It's huge, you know. And so, there's lots of dead-end jobs I worked. I was once employed in a mate's factory drilling asbestos tiles.
These are really shit jobs.
They're proper crap. Nothing even remotely what you'd call a career.
No.
But I remember there was an interesting thing when I was doing the tile drilling where we'll talk about it in a minute. I'd got into uni at this point as a mature student. So I was like early 20s now. And they used to take the mickey at me because they'd been working there for years and I was off to London to do me drama and film and television, you know, and they used to take the mickey at me. And I remember there was a guy there, though. They asked me, would I like to do the night shift because you get paid time and a half? And I was off to uni. I needed the money. I'll do the night shift. So it was just me and him, the guy that used to mock me a bit.
Yeah.
You know, it was just me and him. But this would be an interesting vibe. Bullying's not the right word, but I was the butt of the joke.
Yeah.
It was good natured, but I was very much the young lad, the butt of the joke. He's off to drama.
Seems like this is a play. It is a theatre club.
But I remember he was a Geordie guy, and he said, suddenly his vibe changed. It was just me and him. He saw this university, and he started asking about it. And for the first time, I saw a chink in his arm, and he said, I used to love doing acting and stuff. And suddenly mellowed, softened, and he'd had a bit of experience himself just in plays when he was a kid.
Yeah.
but he was sort of giving me the, you go for it, lad, sort of talk. Yeah. You know what I mean? It was sweet, you know. But it was a reminder that, yeah, I should have a go. I might fail at it, but I'd rather fail and, you know.
So where did you go to university?
I basically had watched you guys on the telly. I'd now been at the Comedy Store in 99, seen it live, and had that epiphany of, now I know where it happens.
Right.
This is, you go to these, because I think someone grew up in the middle, it wasn't a professional, the open spot. I didn't know they were called open spots then.
Yeah.
But this, I'm now introducing a short act. I thought, and it was small, it was such a small club, probably bigger than the one you, the strip joint one, but still, it was intimate. It's like, it seemed like I could literally touch the stage. But I could probably have a go at this one day, right? I know where to come anyway.
Yeah.
But it was still a million miles from being confident enough to do it.
Well, shut up.
And so that night changed everything because I thought, right, if I want to be like these guys, I need to be worldly wise and emotionally secure and be confident enough to go. You couldn't get on that stage with any insecurities, or so I thought. Right? I thought, these guys must be so, I don't know, spiritually enlightened almost. Get on that. They must be so sorted in their head.
Yeah.
You know, cut to me being on the second game. If I'd have known how insecure they all are, I'd have just gone up there and then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I thought, what do I do? Well, I better travel the world. So I went to Australia for a year. I better go to university. I better do the things that you're supposed to do to be that type of person, you know.
Wow.
And so I applied to do drama, film and telly. I just wanted to be a stand-up, but I didn't know where the hell to start that.
You couldn't do it then. There was one, Middlesex Polytechnic did a drama module. Is that where you went?
No, but with Hugh Thompson.
Thomas.
Yeah. He used to be connected with Downstairs at the King's Head. He was compere there.
Yeah.
Well, I was due, I went for an audition to be at West London Institute of Higher Education, which became Brunel. Thank God, because it sounded like an adult learning centre, what it was called. Yeah. West London Institute of Higher Education. Yeah. Brunel sounded far more grand. The first time, it just sounded like I was part of the, I don't know, if you're at West London Institute of Higher Education, it's part of the agreement for leaving prison early. You must attend the West London. And so, but I had to audition to get in. I had to do a monologue. Now, I, at this point, have done some introducing at Pontins. I'd done the Miss Silver Lady beauty contest, which was for ladies of an older age with silver hair, you know, sponsored by Silver Lady, sparkling wine, all this kind of stuff. So I'd done a bit of that, but not performing, not proper performing. And I had to suddenly get on, do an audition to get in. I'd never been in a play, even at school. I'd never done anything. But what I did like at the time was Spitting Image.
Right.
And I used to like the Alan Bennett puppet.
Right.
So I thought, I'll do an Alan Bennett monologue.
Right.
He did Talking Heads with, he was in one of them on television. There's a cream cracker under the sofa. Yeah. So I basically did a really bad Spitting Image impression of Alan Bennett, version of that, and got in somehow. But terrified, absolutely terrified.
So this was to do film and whatever.
Film, television, and John. But what it really was to be a stand-up. And I thought, if I'm in that world, at least it will feel normal to say that. Because I didn't, it's like I had this little secret. I wanted to be a stand-up. I didn't dare tell anybody, you know.
Right.
I could tell these people because they're all like me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I thought it'd be like fame on telly. I thought the TV show, I thought at the break, someone will get up and play the piano and someone will sing in the canteen and I'll do my joke. I'll do my comedy, you know. I had this delusional world of what was going to happen. The reality was I got in, it was 9 hours a week. And I ended up working full-time virtually at William Hills in Hounslow, the bookmakers.
Really?
It wasn't what I thought it was going to be at all. It was still brilliant in terms of it gave me an opportunity to, like, I ran a comedy night myself.
Right.
I booked the acts and I used to host it. So I got a lot from it, you know. But it certainly wasn't this place that
wasn't like Juilliard.
It wasn't like you engulfed me. You only did 9 hours. It was a modular degree and, you know, I had to just get on with being a
student. You're only supposed to teach in that, because this was in the days when university was still, they only were supposed to teach you 9 hours.
They were.
You're only supposed to do 9 hours. I mean, I only did 9 hours a week at art school, but I was supposed to be there every day.
Well, I thought in my head it'd be like, RADA.
Putting
on plays.
But it wasn't. Yeah.
It wasn't like that at all.
Okay.
But what it made me realise was, I better just get on with doing an open spot, hadn't I?
Yeah.
Because no one's going to do it for me. I better just go to my local comedy club, get up and do it. and have a go, which is what I did, you know. And then I met my girlfriend, though, which is now, we've been together 30 odd years now, so she's my wife. But so I remember telling her, oh, I'm going to be a comedian. She went, I'll do it then. I went, all right, yeah, of course. It's like a little dirty secret I had there.
Well, it was. I mean, that was one of the things when the comedy club started, what, you know, you would, no parent would ever say that their child wanted to be a comedian, no, or was a comedian. It was shameful.
Yeah,
it was like, I can't think of anything. You know, it was like being a stripper or, know, it was a...
And of course...
Because of those working...
This was in the early 90s, but
yeah.
Still, it obviously changed a lot since you guys started it all.
Yeah.
But it was only 12 or 13 years later.
Right.
And so, well, 14 years maybe, if it was 1980, did you start all that, maybe? 79? Yeah, 79. So we're talking 14, 15 years later. It had become commercialised a bit. There was jonglers. There was the comedy store had moved. Clubs were starting to open up, and it was no longer it was lucrative, shall we say, business. But it still had a bit of an ethos of that early 80s feel about it. It certainly wasn't what it became. It was the start of that, maybe, in the early 90s. In terms of, well, let's just say, jonglers, for example, there was two clubs when I started out.
Right.
You were still struggling to leave London and make a living.
Yeah.
They just started. There was one maybe in Manchester that was just starting out in the early 90s. There was one in Leicester or somewhere.
Yeah.
But now it became a national thing.
Yeah.
But now it's in decline again in the sense that comedians are struggling again.
What was that one where there was one in Glasgow and there was one in Birmingham?
The Glee Club. Yeah. So like the Glee was another example of proper purpose-built comedy clubs that was starting to spring up. But it's fair to say that for no other reason than the luck of the year I was born, that I hit the circuit at a time when it was absolutely starting to really kick off, so that by the end of the 90s, there was this boom where, you know, when I was properly on the circuit, you'd get Canadian and American comedians flying in just to do it. And go on 4 weeks later because it was financially viable.
Really? And that's just playing like glee clubs and jonglers.
I was regularly playing four a night. I did two comedy stores and two jonglers.
Fuck.
Sometimes five. I'd stick a fifth one in the middle. I had my moped. So I'd regularly do three on a Friday and four on a Saturday. Occasionally a five. It was rare to do a five, but it was just too hard to do.
What sort of money were you making?
Well, so that was, you used to get about 150 quid in cash for a gig. So to earn 600 quid on a Saturday night.
That's a lot, yeah.
You know, I'd never earned more than 100 quid a week in most jobs I'd have. Now I was earning 600 quid on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
I mean, it was rare to be fun. I'm not saying I used to have every week.
But that's true. I mean, as soon as I started doing comedy gigs, I couldn't believe. You know, I just
for 20 minutes?
Yeah.
If you had a proper job. I was earning more in 20 minutes than I'd earned in a week in other jobs.
Yeah.
I don't remember any job where I was walking out with 150 quid at the end of the week. And I get that for 20 minutes. I could not believe it. And I'm not going to lie. Obviously, I do telly. It's very lucrative.
Yeah.
But I've never felt quite as rich as I did back there.
Because
we used to get paid in a similar packet, a little brown envelope.
Yeah.
That used to get me weekly wage. And I'd go, oh my God, it's for 20 minutes. This is just unbelievable, you know. And
I thought for a while I might offer that service where you'd pay like comedian, you know, like in the 90s, something, but you'd pay them and you'd give them cash in a little envelope, you know. Even though they were making that, because there's nothing more. I'm sure people don't have that experience.
If you're working, nothing be the Friday feeling.
Because
if you've had normal jobs, you were always I was always skint.
Yeah,
I mean, in the bingo, I used to earn 65 quid a week. I mean, rent was 25 quid a week in a bed sit. So I had 40 quid. I had it all proportioned off that. I think I could survive 15, 20 quid a week for food if I budgeted well. So 20 quid was my spending money.
Yeah.
But 20 quid when you work, I went behind a bar in the bingo hall. So I didn't have to pay for that. Perhaps I should have done, but there was some perks to being a barman at the bingo club as well. But by payday, you were skint. The idea of being skint on payday was really common. If you grew up in a working class house, you are used to being skint on payday. So nothing beats getting paid.
It was magical. Trophy, magical feeling. So who was your cohort then in terms of who were you?
On the circuit?
On the circuit, yeah.
Yeah, well, my sort of era of starting out was of people that you'll know. There was loads that you won't have heard of because they disappeared or,
yeah,
you know. But the people that were around at that time were Ross Noble. There was the Mighty Boosh were doing a lot on the circuit. They were my sort of Edinburgh cohorts. I used to show flat with them.
Oh,
but
really?
They were starting out. So we did 3 years of flat, 3 or 4 years of flat sharing where they were the talk of the town and I really was not. That was a good lesson.
Yeah.
You know, in, God, it's like the phone would ring. Yeah, I'll just get them. It was always like, you know, they're always being nominated for awards and stuff.
I suppose you wouldn't think of you and them being similar because you, I suppose, of all the people, you carry a certain air of still of the old days.
Yeah, I get told that a lot. And I used to see that as a almost an insult because I used to think they'd use the word mainstream some of them will use it as an insult.
They really
they'd say, you're all right. I mean, you're a bit mainstream, but you're all right. So what you're saying is you're good. Your problem is more than a few people might like you.
Yeah.
You know, and I learned that actually I was lucky in that respect because it got me both worlds in a way. I was able to do Edinburgh. I did a sketch show with Catherine Tate at the time no one had ever heard of, never heard of me either, you know, but we were able to do Edinburgh, sort of hold our own and get those sort of nominations and be part of that world. But also, so when I was at Edinburgh, I used to hear people go, oh, he's all right, but he's a bit of a jongler's comedian.
Right.
Hang on, I'm a jongler's comedian.
Yeah.
Don't have a go at them lot. But likewise, when I used to do jonglers and hear them go, oh, you know, the type, he's an Edinburgh type. Wouldn't last 5 minutes of this sort of late night stag do feeling.
Right.
He's an arty farty wanker. I used to think, hang on, I'm an arty farty wanker when I go to Edinburgh. I wasn't, but I was on that world as well. So
yeah.
I realised, actually, this is a bit of an advantage, you know, to have that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't deliberate. I was just lucky that that's how it was perceived. I wasn't aiming it for that. I just did what I thought was funny, and then everyone else decided what it fitted into, you know.
Yeah, but it's not enforced about it.
No, I certainly wasn't. I still think that now about, let's use Michael McIntyre as an example. If people don't like Michael McIntyre, there's a sort of accusation that he's trying to play to as many people as possible.
Yeah.
So therefore everything's diluted and everything's watered down. No comedian is that good. All comedians can do is what they think is funny.
Right.
And then how many people they play to is determined by other factors, sociological reasons or whatever. I just don't believe comedians are... I don't know many comedians who've tailored it for success.
Right.
I just think they do what they do, and then people decide...
Really?
I think... I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Do you think, do you think that they do?
I think some do, yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong. All I know is that a lot of the people I've seen go on to be successful were doing that when hardly anyone was watching.
Right.
They weren't doing anything massively different back in the day anyway. I mean, I have to say, that example is, I think, crossover with Michael much on the circuit, but from what they tell me, he was doing about sort of stuff to 100 people anyway.
Yeah.
It's not like not like he was walking on a T-shirt going, let me tell you about Marxism. You know, he wasn't.
Yeah, that sold out.
And they go, actually, there's no money in this. I'll put a suit on, I'll do something. You know, most people I know were doing what they do, and some it worked for a big audience, some it didn't.
Yeah.
And so what if it didn't? You know, some of the best comedians I've seen weren't selling out big arenas anyway, you know. So they were still brilliant, albeit to less audience, you know. So, but for me personally, I don't think I've ever had as much fun as I have in smaller clubs.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing more exciting than little King downstairs at the King's Head. We've done like a queue there, you know.
Yeah.
Clubs, but just being on that circuit was probably some of the happier comedy times I've had because that's all I wanted. I genuinely wanted to
really
crack the circuit. It was hard to crack the circuit. If you were to get in at the Comedy Store, was I mean, it sounds like you started it off. So
I do.
You didn't have to ring them and say, could have it.
No, I was the first person.
You were the first person. Yeah.
Yeah.
A bit harder for some of us coming later. We used to have to ring Don Warlip and go, Don, please, can I just have another open spot?
No, I bought Don's first house in south of France.
Oh, right. Okay. Know. Yeah, well, we had all the benefits of you lot starting it up.
Yeah.
And all the negatives of everyone phoning him and wanting to get on the bill. Because it still has that cachet. The comedy store is still the club, you know. To want to be in. Well, listen, I'm getting older now. I don't know what it is anymore. But certainly when I was on the circuit, nothing was better than playing the store. Because I think it had the history of what you lot had started. So we thought, this is the... You know,
yeah.
There was pictures on the wall of you lot. And like, you know, oh my God, can I play this club as well? And it was hard to get in, you know. It was a battle. So when to crack the circuit was genuinely, hand on all I wanted, because... If you wanted to be on telly, you were in the wrong job. Stand-up wasn't working on telly then. There was no
really?
There was no real stand-up shows on telly. There'd obviously been Friday Night Live and Saturday Night Live. They changed its name, didn't it, when it changed the day of the week. But you saw stand-up then. But those comedians, from what I can see, would leave the show and then carry on going on the circuit. You know, it wasn't like they were launched into fame as a stand-up necessarily. There still was a perception, certainly when I was doing it, that stand-up doesn't work on telly.
Really?
Yeah, very much.
What were you doing?
You're in the wrong job if you want to be famous.
Really?
You
know? Oh, okay. Yeah. What were you doing for material? Did you write all your own material?
Yeah, totally. So I was like, I was very much, I don't want to say gag teller, but nothing was true. I remember when I started out, everything was, it's very rare that I would say, do you know what I noticed? Or do you know what happened to me? I ever talked about me nan, it was a fictional nan for the sake of a joke.
But that's one of the things. I mean, that is, for me, I mean, we've sort of derided those mechanical gag tellers, but a good fucking gag is the greatest.
Well, I think part of our business. One thing that even people that never tell a joke on
stage,
a traditional setup punchline,
will
still... No, I had a good one the other day.
Yeah.
They'll still tell me. We all appreciate a very well good job.
And in between, people don't, reviewers and stuff, because they don't really understand the craft of it, I think. But always in between, you know, people would see with me, you know, the Marxism and the Bertolt Brecht impressions and the anger and the, you know, the kind of counter, you know, the hatreds are in classes. But within that, woven in with that, it's just a lot of solid fucking gags.
Solid gags. Well, it's interesting. Yeah. I used to absolutely love, when we first got together, me and my, keep calling it, then girlfriend, now, I'm just making the point that the person who I've been with for 30 years, we were at college, we met at that college that I just talked about, at uni. And at that time, Alexis Ailes' stuff was on. Right. That was what it was called, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting that I'm talking about stand-up not working on telly, because your stand-up was, you were walking down the street.
Yeah, doing stand-up,
You were on, so it's not, I think there was ways of doing stand-up on telly.
Yeah.
But the, standing there with a mic, with an audience, was seen as, and I see what they mean, it's like, you're never going to be able to recreate that club.
No, exactly.
It's like
that's
diluted. So you weren't trying to recreate that. You did it whilst walking down the street.
Yeah.
But it was still stand-up.
Yeah.
It was still...
Most of it was stuff I'd done.
Yeah, it was called stuff, and it was stuff.
Yeah. But it was also material I'd done.
Probably in clubs, right?
Yeah.
But you obviously felt, why do it in the club? If it's, I don't know, whatever reason.
Well, not clubs, darling, big theatres.
Well, yeah, but I'm making the point that in front of an audience.
Yeah.
You were doing it in front of an audience, but you chose not to do that on the telly, right?
Yeah. Because we felt like it didn't. It was fake. Because we'd done, before we did the Young Ones, Paul Jackson, we did two omnibus, we did two shows doing our acts. And then the first one, we were in like one of the studios in Television Centre, and because that they weren't allowed alcohol, so there was an audience drinking coloured water while we did our acts with the fucks taken out.
Right.
And it felt like,
of course. And to me, it was, you know, love it or hate it, the reason why Live at the Apollo, I think, became successful was because, well, look, when we were being told, my generation of comics on the, when we were being told stand-up doesn't work on telly, the number one number one, but the big selling things of VHSs were stand-ups in theatres.
Right.
So Eddie Izzard was in the charts, Lee Evans was in the charts,
right.
But stand-up doesn't work on telly, but they're putting that cassette in and watching it on the telly.
Yeah.
So I thought, that doesn't make sense, that. Because so what I think they did realise they were doing wrong was stand-up made for telly, as opposed to filming a live event.
Right.
That was working. But if you're looking down the barrel of the lens and having to fabricate... There's been loads of attempts at sort of stand-up show, and I've been on some of them, where they put little tables out.
Yes, yes,
well,
yes.
Well, Tap of the Shunters was that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Back in the 70s. But to try and recreate it wasn't working, so don't recreate it. Just put it on in a theatre and film the
like event. Stuart Lee's show or something. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I tell you what, that's when it did start working.
Right.
They're filming the event rather than making it for the telly.
So, right.
Again, love it or hate it, it was a success live at the Apollo. And I think that's where they realised, well, hang on, do what the DVDs are doing. Do you just film it in a club and don't have them looking down the lens.
Right.
You know, just film the event, you know.
Okay, then. Well, that's obviously part one of Lexicon podcast with Lee Mack. We'll be coming back as soon as we get ready with part two, in which Lee talks more about, I think, his sitcom, Not Going Out, which has been on the telly for a long time. And it's, you know, it's new, you know, to do a sitcom these days takes a lot of lot of skill, I think, you know, and just, you know, it's his kind of evolution as a performer, really. So, yeah. Tune in to when we get it ready. We will drop part two of Lexi Sale, Wolf Mabanga, and Lee Mack.
And I just want to say thanks to everyone for the lovely feedback on the last episode, the Reflectorama one.
Yeah.
That was nice. We took a gamble doing that kind of concept.
Yeah, I mean, we should. I mean, we don't. I mean, I think people like me and you just do you know, chatting anyway, don't they? I don't know whether, I mean, from time to time. So we hadn't done that for a while.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, the fact that it's a look back over. I mean, it's a, you know, it's not a, it's a rickety old thing, isn't it, this podcast? It's not, it comes out when it feels like it.
yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a bizarre range of people. But, you know, for those that love it, I think, you know, there's, for if this is the sort of thing you love, then you will love this. I mean, it is. I think for a few, you know, for a select group of people with terrific taste, this is just the greatest
the bee's
podcast
knees,
there is.
Yeah,
it's the greatest thing that there's ever been.
It's the best podcast available.
I should say also that my radio series, Strangers on the Train, seems to have really broken through. We got 5 stars in the Daily Mail. A really good preview in Guardian, I think, in the Times as well.
The Mail gave you 5 stars.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they don't, you know. They just preview.
Like, how does that feel? Like to be lauded by something that you kind of disagree with
it's
so
not
much.
Like it's. Well, I think that the show itself is not. You know, it's an inoffensive show. You know,
well, certainly, yeah.
So it's fine. I don't, you know, I'll take it. I'll take whatever plaudits I can get, really. I think it just, you know, and I mean, in a way, I suppose you could say that somebody like me who won't dilute their politics, but on the other hand, can make something because as mainstream as that show is a testament to me, I suppose, in a way.
Was it the one with Bidil on it that they gave 5 stars to?
No,
interesting.
That was the one before.
But how many more episodes of that are left?
There's 5 in this series, so there's another 3.
And what day and time does it air?
Saturday, 10:30 in the morning.
There we go.
It's a nice little slot.
Probably on BBC Sounds as well.
And it's on Sounds and all that. And I think it's repeated during the week, during the week as well.
Nice.
But yeah, it seems to have... you know, sometimes when you're doing a thing, it suddenly you feel a kind of click with the public where it suddenly you know, people start, you know, it suddenly you feel like it's connected with a large number of a large number of members of the public, really. And it's you know, it's a nice feeling. It doesn't mean the BBC won't cancel it, but
it's a very podcasty format as well.
It is, in a sense, yeah. And yeah,
people do like just listening to people chatting.
Yeah, it's very soothing, I think. I mean, I myself, if I can relax, I find it soothing. You know, it's and occasionally there is. I don't know if we're doing Edinburgh Aberdeen next week, but particularly the opening interview in that is just amazing. I think, I mean, just extraordinary radio.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. And it's also, I should say, doing this podcast, that's made, I don't think I would have had the skill to talk to all those strangers without having the, you know, having done the hundreds of hours on this podcast.
Dealing with me.
Dealing with you. But also with, you know, all the people.
Yeah, because it's not always your celebrity chums, is it? Sometimes it's someone you've never met before. It's just they wrote an article you're interested in, and now you have to make an hour and a half conversation with them.
Exactly. So it's that skill in talking to people that, you know, I think it's come from me. I wouldn't have been able to do it without this podcast, I think. So thank you, everybody.
Can I ask you a really random question before we go?
For sure.
What are your thoughts on Peter Gabriel?
Peter Gabriel?
Yeah, the works of.
I quite like Peter Gabriel. Obviously, I mean, I was only really into his, you know, that sort of burst of stuff that he had in whenever that was, really, you know, Games Without Frontier and stuff like that is when I was most attuned with his work. Why do you ask?
I think he's a fascinating artist, and I like some of the later stuff he's done. I love the early, like Sledgehammer is just such a perfect song. But he's done some later stuff with orchestras.
Yeah, no, he
did a song about a South African prisoner of war called Biko, about Stephen Biko. And I just thought I think he's a fascinating artist, and I was wondering, I was going to ask you, who do you prefer, Peter Gabriel or Elton John, just as a random question. I was also wondering if you'd met him or had any stories in the 80s.
I don't know whether I did meet him once. Did I? Was he there? Yeah. He was. It's a long story.
Random question, like I said, had nothing to do with anything.
He's an artist who continued to make interesting work. And of course, now he's one. He's a bald guy.
Yep. He's a beardy balder.
He's a beardy bald guy. It was me and Nigel Planer have just been away up north in Annick near making Celebrity Antiques Road Trip. And we stayed at a golf course.
Yeah.
And golfers have changed now.
Yeah.
There were all these shiny-headed men, like hundreds of them, all with shaven heads. And they all wear shorts and sort of tight, clingy, dark. I guess they're wicky, you know, tops that kind of wick away sweat.
Yeah.
Clingy kind of polo shirts and shorts with kind of dark shorts with like a white belt. And they're very unfriendly. That's golfers now, at least in the summer.
Interesting. I played golf last week, so I'm the exception. Me and my friends, like, causing trouble on the golf course. It's a really fun game. The people who play it are twats, and they kind of ruin it.
You feel like these, you know, we live in a sort of self-confirming world, don't we, left politics and what have you, and you just think these golfers are not.
Because it's an expensive hobby. So any expensive hobby tends to be dominated by dickheads, right?
I haven't really thought it through. It has particular characteristics, doesn't it? You know, of businessmen on the golf course and all that. And
it doesn't need to be. I think it could be. It's so fun and relaxing. And it takes a lot of concentration, and it's really fucking satisfying when you hit the ball. It's a bit of
an environmental catastrophe. I mean, not so much in this country, even in this country.
Yeah, like the Dubai, I've played on a course in Abu Dhabi, My rich uncle took me to play golf, like family friend.
Well, that shouldn't be there, should it?
And it shouldn't, no.
No.
Yeah. But, you know, you think it was invented by like rough Highlanders who were just passing the time on a mountain site.
Yeah.
And now it's all elite. It's awful. Trump.
Yeah, Trump. Yeah, that's all you have to say, really. Trump.
Maybe I need a new hobby.
Yes.
All right, I think we've yammered on enough, right?
Yeah.
Next time, more Lee Mack, yeah?
No, more Lee Mack and, yeah, a Wilf update as well. Yeah. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkuti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.